Hello, this is Stephanie.
And this is Brian.
Welcome to the making and the remaking of A Codependent Mind. This is the first episode of season 6. This season, we're going to be focused on the book we just released, also titled The Making and the Remaking of A Codependent Mind. Both the ebook version and the paperback are now available on Amazon. There'll be a link in the show notes directly to the book. The book covers about roughly the same period as the first two seasons of the podcast.
But as we've said many times throughout the podcast, we learned so much just during the making of the podcast about my past, about codependency, about our relationship. So this book is really the most up-to-date thinking that we have about how my codependent behaviors developed and how I healed. So there is both new information in the book and, I think, clearer, more actionable descriptions of my experiences and how they relate to codependency.
So what we're going to do with this season is Brian is going to read aloud the chapters. If you'd like, you could just listen to the whole book over the course of the season, or you can buy the book and read along. Brian wrote in the acknowledgement section of the book, but it really can't be said enough. We're so thankful for all the listeners of this podcast, with special thanks to those who have reached out and shared their own stories and offered encouragement and support. It's been such a meaningful journey. And with that, I will turn it over to The Codependent Mind.
Part 1, The Making of a Codependent Mind. Chapter 1, Codependent Beginnings. Codependency is not a disease. I did not catch it or cure it. It was not passed down to me through my genetic inheritance. I was not born with it. It is not a personality trait. I am not codependent like I am introverted or clever or conscientious or adventurous. Rather, codependency is a set of learned behaviors, behaviors that once served me well. Faced with situations in which my needs were not being met or I felt unsafe, I adopted these behaviors as an effective response. I adapted. Human beings have been doing this for hundreds of thousands of years. Our ability to adapt to novel situations and environments has been critical to our survival as a species. When I was young, I received signals from my environment, my family, my friendships, my community, that the world was unpredictable, chaotic, hostile, and sometimes violent. The codependent behaviors allowed me to feel some measure of control in situations where, as a child, I had very little power. The problem with the set of behaviors clustered together under the heading of codependency is that outside of that initial environment, they became maladaptive, meaning they began to prevent me from finding and creating the kinds of relationships with other people that I desperately needed and desired, ones in which I felt seen, safe, and connected. Not only did they become a barrier to intimate, loving relationships, they got me entangled with disordered people, stuck in toxic friendships and romantic relationships, and left me feeling lonely, resentful, and depressed for most of my adult life. Although the environment had changed, and I was no longer a powerless child, these behaviors had become so habituated, so automatic, that they were my default way of relating to others. Codependent behaviors are interpersonal in nature and form as a result of human interaction. Once conditioned, any or all of the behaviors may occur to some extent during casual interactions with strangers, all the way up to enmeshed relationships. When discussing the behaviors that fall under the umbrella of codependency, it's important to note that all of them are normal, natural human reactions to other people. The problem arises when these reactions become pathological, inauthentic, and compulsive. Here are the most common behaviors that are grouped as codependency, and what the codependent versions have looked like in my life. Feeling responsible for others' emotions. I was led to feel that other people's emotional reactions are unsafe, and that I was somehow directly implicated in resolving or managing those emotions. Compliance. I felt as though other people were more powerful or more important, so would often default to a position of compliance, regardless of what I actually felt or believed. people-pleasing. Because I had an exaggerated fear of disappointing or upsetting other people, I often wound up just telling people what I thought they wanted to hear, or behaving how I thought they wanted me to behave. Caretaking. I went out of my way to keep the most threatening people in my life safe, physically, emotionally, financially, sexually, in an attempt to indirectly keep myself safe. This caretaking was often at my own expense, or at the expense of others in my life who were less of an immediate threat. Lack of boundaries. As a result of the overemphasis placed on other people's wants, needs, and desires, I ignored my own boundaries and compromised my identity, thus putting myself and people around me at risk. The word codependency is an admittedly misleading one. I came across the term a handful of times, but didn't delve deeply into its meaning, even when, at one point in my early 20s, my best friend and I wondered if we were codependent. The two of us felt too dependent on each other and were unable to cope outside the bubble of safety we had formed. We didn't realize that what we thought of as codependent wasn't what the term was referring to at all, and at that point, I didn't explore it any further. I continued to randomly stumble across the term, but it didn't resonate despite my being very much in the throes of codependent behaviors. Years later, while in an abusive romantic relationship, the term came up again in a group therapy session. I can't remember why, but it was suggested I try a CODA meeting, which is Codependence Anonymous, which I did. The way I remembered it being presented there was that codependency was more of an addiction in which the codependent person somehow becomes dependent on caring for or even controlling other people, usually other disordered people with addictions of their own, most commonly alcoholism. This wasn't my experience, so once again, I put the idea out of my mind. Ultimately, I have not found it useful to think of codependency as an addiction. That language suggests that it is the behaviors themselves that are the root of the problem. While it's true that people with codependent behaviors can get stuck in toxic relationships with other disordered people, including people with dependency disorders like alcoholism, the codependent person isn't necessarily there because they are addicted to caretaking. Far more likely is that they ended up caring for a disordered person because they had existing codependent habits and behaviors that were activated in that relationship. More helpful, I think, is to approach codependent behaviors as learned, strategic, adaptive responses to feelings of powerlessness, to emotional pain. These behaviors function as a solution to the pain and/or powerlessness people experience. Unfortunately, the solution is not effective in the long run. Once the behaviors become habitual and disordered, they are maladaptive in that they counterproductively cause more pain and powerlessness than they relieve. Like most disorders, I think it's helpful to think of codependency as falling on a spectrum of severity. People who find themselves inadvertently stuck for a period of time in a caretaking pattern with a disordered person might fall on the less severe end of this spectrum, if they can even be considered codependent at all. Neither caring for people nor trying to please them is necessarily disordered behavior. It's when these behaviors become compulsive that a person will start to move along towards the more severe end of the spectrum. The behaviors start to significantly compromise their relationships and their own needs and desires. By the time a person gets to the severe end of the codependency spectrum, the behaviors are much more unconscious, automatic, and all-encompassing, and can result in a loss of identity and autonomy. I spent most of my life on the severe end of the codependency spectrum. Fortunately, what has been learned can be unlearned. What has been made can be remade. In order to do that, however, I needed to go back to the beginning, to the environment in which I learned these behaviors. I needed the origin story. My origin story. My immediate family consisted of myself, two parents, and an older brother. My dad worked at an office on the weekdays, while my mom took care of us kids at home. We lived in a comfortably sized house in a relatively safe suburban neighborhood near a big park in all the schools that I would attend. My parents involved me and my brother in various activities from an early age, like Cub Scouts, soccer, and baseball. We would go camping regularly in our trailer, sometimes going on group outings with a club for families with young children. There were families who lived nearby with kids close to our ages that we'd visit, and we had a fairly regular contact with extended family, grandparents, aunts, uncles. We attended church every Sunday. For the most part, I remember a sense of security and predictability at home. Neither one of my parents were abusive people. Neither of them had some kind of entitlement or delusions of grandeur. On average, they seemed to get along with each other, and the atmosphere in our house when we were together was generally calm. They felt like good people who meant well for themselves, for my brother and me, and for our family. My parents are both alive, still married, living together, and until recently lived in the same house where I grew up. I wasn't close with my parents or my brother after leaving the house, but we kept in touch and got together regularly for holidays. We maintained a connection with each other that I never quite understood, but somehow it felt fine, comfortable. That's basically how I viewed my relationship with my family before doing any of the work I've now done to understand myself. For years, there was something about my childhood, my family, that I felt I needed to protect. Something that kept me from being honest with myself about my experiences. That there didn't seem to be any kind of major conflict between anyone in my family, and overall I felt comfortable around them, made me want to hold on to certain narratives. I think, like most people, I generally divided my experiences into buckets of good and bad. For the people I was able to more easily label as bad, and particularly for those who were no longer in my life, it was easy. Bad bucket. However, for those that were still in my life, like my family, I just wanted to throw those into the good bucket and keep that view intact. But experiences are rarely that simple or cut and dry. While I was able to acknowledge to an extent some of the negative behaviors of my parents, I fell short of looking at how I was affected by their behaviors. It's as if I felt that by thinking of anyone in my family in a bad light, I wasn't being fair, and that the universe would somehow judge me harshly for those thoughts. My parents were loving people that provided for me. How dare I think anything bad about them, let alone say it out loud? However, it was important for me to learn that having negative experiences with people doesn't necessarily mean that they are bad people, and not all bad behavior is abusive. I can still love someone and want them in my life while also being honest about how that relationship affected me. I came to understand that my incomplete, misleading beliefs and stories about my early experiences, that my always putting my family in the good bucket, wasn't helping me. I had to be honest about my full experience. Understanding my family of origin, honestly looking at the impact on me of certain experiences, was the beginning of an understanding of my own behaviors and was crucial to my self-awareness and healing. One of the more significant things to have an early impact on me was the way my dad handled his emotions, most notably the way he often defaulted to anger responses. He was an extremely impatient person and seemed to experience significant anxiety when faced with any lack of control of his surroundings. He was very routine-oriented, and had a hard time if things didn't go the way he hoped or planned, or if something was more difficult than he had expected. When that happened, whatever the reason, he would get very flustered and lash out in anger. The outbursts were loud and sharp, and usually involved cursing. His tone was very frightening and destabilizing for me, and I still feel the effects to this day when I hear it. His angry outbursts were directed at anything and everything. Sometimes they were directed at me, sometimes my brother, sometimes my mom, but just as often they were directed at things around him, objects, situations. He would fly off the handle at anything that caused him a sense of frustration or loss of control. Some of the more common ones, when the garage door didn't latch properly, if he discovered ants anywhere in the house, if something wasn't functioning the way he wanted it to. Calls from telemarketers. Leaving the house was also often difficult for him since it would involve an increase in elements beyond his control, especially when driving. He lashed out at traffic, at people driving badly, if he was having trouble navigating. The tone of those angry outbursts frightened me, regardless of who or what they were directed at, although they had an even bigger impact when they were directed at me, my brother, or my mom. Sometimes the anger was directed at everyone in the house. If someone left a light on, didn't close a door, didn't put something back in the correct place, or left a wet spot on the countertop, he would shout something that usually included, "God damn it!" among other things. Obviously, when I was a young child, there were a lot of things I didn't know how to do, or do well. I also didn't always act in the way he expected, or wanted me to. Anytime this disconnect caused frustration in him, the result was usually that same angry outburst. For example, doing math flashcards with me, or helping my brother and me with our monthly Boy Scout paper drives, often resulted in outbursts as he got frustrated, perhaps by our lack of understanding or speed. The anger directed at my mom, brother, or me wasn't always because of something we did wrong. Sometimes it was just that he had an idea of something one or all of us should do, and if anyone didn't want to do it for whatever reason, he would get angry. Or if he had advice for how to do something and one of us wanted to do it a different way. In those instances, he had a common phrase he would include in the resulting angry explosion. "Fine, I don't care anymore." Though obviously he did care, and in reality he usually wasn't giving up when he said that. The majority of time, my dad was a good-natured, jovial guy, joking around a lot and playing with my brother and me. I feel the effects of those experiences too. In general, I wasn't afraid of my dad or in some kind of permanent state of fear, but I was definitely afraid of those outbursts of anger and impatience. I found myself trying to figure out how to avoid them however I could, by noticing specific things that set him off and by doing my best to not irritate him. If I failed in those efforts, I would try to find a way to calm him down as quickly as possible. I felt unsafe when he was angry. The need to diffuse my dad's anger and appease him goes back as far as I can remember. I was learning that I couldn't really trust one of my caretakers, that emotions were scary, and that I needed to somehow manage my dad's anger. I remember how quickly his emotional switch could flip from anger to something else, as long as he was successfully appeased, or if he was distracted by something else. Minutes later, he could be laughing again as if nothing had happened. It wasn't just me that needed to avoid or contain my dad's anger. My mom and brother were also in the line of fire. They both used similar tactics as I did: avoid situations and behaviors that would likely cause an explosion, and if one happened, attempt to appease, soothe, or pacify my dad. I have no memories of my mom sticking up for me when my dad was directing his anger at me, but I do remember times when the anger was directed at her and she tried to fight back. It never seemed to work. My dad would just escalate, and she would back down. In that way, my mom modeled compliance behavior as an appropriate response to his anger. From observing her behavior, I learned how to comply. If someone was angry, upset, or frustrated, I needed to figure out how to calm that anger, or stop it before it began. In addition to my dad's anger, a defining feature of my childhood was my mom's negativity. She seemed to feel powerless over pretty much everything in her life, and she expressed her resentment about that to us in various ways. She behaved as if she had no say in the things in her life, where we lived, what her role was in her relationship with my dad, the types of family activities we did. But she would make sure that we were all aware of her bitterness about those things. She would regularly complain about my dad's behaviors to my brother and me, even when we were young children. She was convinced that the universe was out to get her or us. "That's just our family's luck." And "this always happens to us" were common refrains when bad things happened. My mom was my primary caregiver, and I recall a feeling of safety that went with that. She would be the one I usually ran to when I got injured and needed comforting. She was very involved when it came to providing experiences for my brother and me. Birthdays, holidays, extracurricular activities, she did a lot for us. In general, I don't have memories of her shouting at me or losing her temper. I remember her as a warm and loving mother. Looking back, however, I can also see the ways in which her negativity impeded her ability to provide me with the love and care that I needed. Her disappointments, resentments, bitterness, and depression were always close to the surface. These were clearly painful emotions that she struggled to deal with, similar to how my dad struggled with his painful emotions. Whether it was expressing her frustrations and disappointments about my dad, or with her life in general, my brother and I were often enlisted to provide her validation and support in managing her emotions. My caretaking behaviors definitely came in large part from trying to manage my dad's anger, but they also came from feeling responsible for my mom's powerlessness and negativity. My mom has described me repeatedly over the years, including recently, as a difficult baby who cried a lot and was clingy. While babies can certainly have different temperaments, and indeed I may have been difficult in some ways, it is also possible that I cried a lot and was clingy because my needs were not being met. I was a second child, coming less than 2 years after my brother. My mom had two babies to care for, lived away from her family and support system, and had a husband who did not help much with childcare. From a difficult baby, I became a very compliant child. This was my version of people-pleasing. Some children might become the family clown or the family mediator or the golden child, the one who excels at everything. Me, I ate food I didn't like, played sports I didn't enjoy, took piano lessons for years, never complaining that I didn't like playing the piano. It became hard for me to really recognize what I actually wanted, to become my true self. I found myself having difficulty making basic decisions or taking any sort of initiative without deferring to someone else. Not only was I not being true to myself with these behaviors, I was being dishonest with others. I was developing a habit of reflexive dishonesty, betraying myself, and not really authentically connecting with other people. These are not behaviors one is born with. All infants are very comfortable at expressing their dislikes, their preferences, their discomfort, their distress. They have to be. That is the only way they can get their needs met. Meeting a child's needs doesn't just mean addressing their physical needs. There are emotional needs as well. Children need love, care, and attention. These needs are equally as compelling and important as their physical needs, and they regularly make bids to get those needs met. Sometimes those bids can be relentless and aren't always easy to understand or respond to. But what happens when certain types of needs, physical or emotional, are regularly dismissed or reacted to negatively? An example, when my dad used to watch evening news between the time he got home from work and dinner, if any of us made any sort of bid for attention during those times, he would get very upset, waving us away, shouting something like, "Shh, listen, I'm trying to listen." He was telling us, in a forceful, threatening way, that connecting with me, with us, was less important than watching television. Such experiences led me to feel unsafe in expressing my need for his attention, assistance, or affection. All of these experiences played a role in the way I responded to the world around me internally and interpersonally. While I generally felt physically safe and the world around me seemed stable and secure, emotionally and interpersonally, things were much more fraught. Sometimes I would get a playful, engaged father, sometimes an angry, scary father. Sometimes I would get a loving and responsive mother, sometimes a depressed and resigned mother. I unconsciously internalized their emotions as if they were my responsibility. This was the environment that gave rise to my codependent behaviors. From a place of powerlessness, I was learning to put other people's needs ahead of my own, to take them on, and to feel responsible for them. My needs were not only unimportant, they were often dismissed or overruled. I learned that it was unsafe to upset my dad or disappoint my mother. Far safer was for me to suppress or ignore my own desires and fall in line with whatever I thought they wanted or needed from me. My parents worked with what they had. I believed, and still believe, that they meant well for my brother and me, and they both made quite a bit of effort to care for us within their limitations. I don't carry resentment towards them for the negative experiences, at least not anymore. But to understand how my codependent mind was formed, I had to acknowledge the negative experiences while also acknowledging the positive, and to recognize that both can be present in the same relationship. I also needed to understand that it was within my home environment that my codependent behaviors started forming, behaviors that I would carry with me into the world outside my house.
And that concludes Chapter 1 of The Making and the Remaking of a Codependent Mind, currently available on Amazon in ebook or paperback. We very much appreciate any reviews that you could leave on that site, and we hope you join us in a couple of weeks for Chapter 2.